first of all, let me just ask you what happens to you when you have those moments, the moment of silence like we had right there. What goes on in your mind?
Well, you have what we call silence is an external phenomenon. You would say that's the absence of noise. And then you have stillness. The way I use the word stillness is the inner silence. And stillness or inner silence means that there is a gap in between thoughts. So there is a little bit of space inside your mind, so to speak. And in that space, you are fully aware and fully present, but there's no conceptual thinking going on. So there are no words arising in that space. And that's what we call stillness. So most people have a voice in their head, which is the continuous thought processes that they are usually identified with. So for most people, that is their basic reality, is the voice in the head, and they are so identified with these continuously arising thought processes that they don't even know that they are identified with every thought that comes. They don't know that there is a voice in the head because they are the voice in the head. So to find that there is another dimension inside you that we could call stillness, we could have other names for it, where this mental noise is not operating for a while, that is like finding a depth inside yourself that perhaps you didn't know was there. And that essentially is the spiritual dimension. So it's really is about finding that dimension in yourself where the continuous mental noise for a while subsides. So when your question then is, what goes on in your mind? We could say nothing really goes on as such. There's still an awareness of noises that you hear, or your eyes may be open. You might be looking at things, but you're not labeling the noises that you hear. You're not interpreting them. They're just there. You know they're there. And or if there are visual perceptions, you're not labeling compulsively, this compulsive labeling that most people live with, that subsides for a while, and that's an incredible liberation.
Why, I mean, I guess in a practical sense, what would you recommend to people who are going to be watching this, who are having their very busy days, you know, grabbing half a cup of coffee, running to work with, you know, the half a bagel in their hand, missing the bus, reading the paper, listening to their iPhone on their BlackBerry? What common practice should they be doing during the day to get to that place?
Yeah, good question, because most people's reality is that one thing after another arises, one thought after another, one thing after another that you need to deal with. And in most people's lives, there's no space at all. And if they talk about space, they'll tell you, I don't have time for space. There's so much going on, I don't have time to sit down and take. But that is not true. That's actually the mind speaking. The thought processes want to carry on. They have a certain momentum of their own. But everybody has time for a moment of space, and that could start with a simple thing like taking one conscious in and out breath occasionally while you're waiting at a bus stop or at the traffic light or while you're going up or down in the elevator, instead of mentally projecting yourself forward to the next thing that you have to do, that you're going to, or that you haven't done. And why not take a moment when you're simply conscious of your breath? You're breathing in, the breath is always there, so you just put some attention on that. One conscious in-breath, feel the air going into the body, and one conscious out-breath. And during that space, you have taken attention away from the voice in the head, as I call it, and a little bit of space has opened up inside you. And that feels good. And in that little space, you feel a bit more alive. There's a certain aliveness and power in that space. It's not just nothingness. There is a power in there. And so that's one thing you can do occasionally. Everybody has time for one conscious in and out breath. And there's so much time that people spend waiting for things, but usually while they wait, they're immersed in thinking. But why not use the waiting time to just become more conscious? So this is one thing they can do, take a conscious breath. Another thing I recommend is to get in touch with what I call the inner body, which means to feel that your body is alive, to get in touch with the sense of aliveness inside your body. And sometimes people don't know what I'm talking about, so I always recommend, if they don't know what I'm talking about, can you feel a certain aliveness in your hands? So you have to direct your attention, your inner attention to that, and feel, yes, I can feel a little bit of warmth or tingling inside my hands. Now, to the mind, that's a meaningless thing. It says, I have other more important things to worry about than my hands. But it is vitally important to get in touch with that basic aliveness so that you are not only up here in the head all the time. You become more rooted in yourself, more deeply rooted in being. And you can start with a simple thing like feeling the aliveness in your hands. And if you can do that, you can also feel it perhaps in your feet and in your arms and your legs. And perhaps then suddenly you feel your entire body is alive. Every cell is alive. Most people have lost that sense of basic aliveness because all their attention is continuously absorbed by thought processes. I'm not saying don't think anymore. Of course, we need to think to operate in this world, and thinking is a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful tool. But not to be able to get out of it at all, that is a very dreadful state, really. And most of one's thinking is not creative. Psychologists have examined the nature of thought, and they found that 98 to 99% of one's thoughts are very repetitive. They tend to be the same thoughts. So a lot of thinking that goes on is actually quite useless. And not only useless, it's often very negative. And the more negative thinking you do, the more negative thoughts you have, the more the body responds with corresponding negative emotions, anxiety, regret, fear, guilt, all kinds of things that the body always reflects your thought processes. That's the emotion reflects your thoughts. So just to experience that you are not your thoughts. You are the awareness behind your thoughts. And to know that, you have to find that little space inside. So I've just given these two ways of doing it. And you can do it during the day. It doesn't take long. Everybody has time for that, because there's so much waiting time in one's life, even in a busy life.
You know, I want to ask you, one of the things that was so interesting to me that you started with The Power of Now and then have continued in this book was about this little voice and how it can contribute to conflict with other people, because you made a list of those emotions, but the other voice in there, that ego voice, can be envy, can be the voice that you think that something's been done to you by somebody else, you know, that brings up these kind of resentments.
Yes.
And this is a very exciting thought, because it has to do with not just little conflicts between people, but larger conflicts. So can you talk about that voice and how we have to still it as far as our relationships with other people and perhaps even other countries and all kinds of things like that?
Yes. Now, because people are so identified with the voice in their head, after a while, certain thoughts tend to be repetitive thoughts that one thinks, and a certain mind-based image arises in the mind that they are thoughts that you identify with as yourself, the memories that you have, the things that you have done, or the things that people did to you, and all kinds of things that you identify with mentally, that you think that is who I am. So we call that the ego. The ego is a mind-made sense of self, a me based on mind activity. So Now, the ego has certain has a certain structure to it. It needs certain things to survive. It needs to emphasize the otherness, as I call it, of others. So it needs to judge people. It needs to immediately conceptualize and define a person that you meet. Immediately you will find judgments arising and comparison arriving. How the image of who I am, how does that compare to this person? Inferiority, superiority. The ego needs enemies, because by creating an enemy outside, somebody who is against me, I emphasize that sense of self, the mind-made sense of self. So there is a basic dysfunction built into the structure of the ego. And so if that works both on a personal level and on a collective level, because there's the collective ego of tribes and nations, or whatever the collective derives its identity from. It could be a religion too. And so you have the struggle between tribes, nations, religions against the others, the non-believers, or the evil others. Continuously you have that playing itself out in history. There's always the other tribe, the other nation, the other religion, or even the other sect within the same religion is the enemy. So there's this built-in tendency to make others into enemy. Why is that? Because the ego needs to emphasize this, the otherness. By creating enemies outside, you have a stronger sense of who you are, but it's a false sense of who you are. An example of that in Nazi Germany, for example, they ended up making the whole world into an enemy. There were enemies in the East, enemies in the West, everywhere. And of course, at that time, people had a very strong sense of national identity. Very few people committed suicide at that time, because they were so immersed in this false sense of self that gave them a temporary feeling of, now we know who we are, because we are. So the boundary between self and other becomes very rigid.
We are different than everyone else, yes. And we are better than everyone else.
Yes. And similar things, some religions, they emphasize the evil non-believers. And once you have conceptualized another tribe or another group, you can no longer feel their humanity and their aliveness, because they have you have transformed them into a mental concept. You attach a label to them. Once you've done that, violence becomes possible, and you don't feel anymore what you are doing to another human being, because you have already dehumanized the other human being by transforming them into a mental concept. But before you did that, you had already done it to yourself without knowing it, because you had identified with certain mental concepts and said, that's me. The collective one is, that is us. That is our identity. That is who we are. These are our beliefs. That's our history, whatever it is. So all false, you already derive your sense of self from only from concepts, and then you impose the same thing on others. And then there's the structural need then to make that even stronger, so the enemies arise. So humans, if you read a history book, you'll see continuous, completely senseless and pointless warfare between nations. The worst of it was the 20th century. And so when you see that, then there's no doubt that there is a very strong element of dysfunction in the human mind. And really, this is what we are addressing when we become more conscious of compulsive thinking, and we become conscious that we have been deriving our sense of self from what we've been telling ourselves in our minds of who we are, in other words, from thinking, then suddenly we see this operating in ourselves. We see this unconscious process operating in ourselves, and by seeing it, another dimension has arisen. I call it awareness or presence.
You know, I'm fascinated about, you know, I've kind of leaped over to your new book, and of course one of the, I guess, most inspiring aspects of reading your story, especially, you know, I'm a mother of a teenager, and teenagers can get very low on themselves sometimes, and as all people have moments of great darkness, and you hope that there'll be a moment that they'll see the light or something that will happen to get them over. And so I'm wondering if you can describe to me your moment of great darkness and how that turned into light.
Well, I was at that time I was 29, and for most of my 20s I had been living in states of depression and anxiety. I was very rarely, moments of happiness were very, very rare. So I was basically an unhappy human being, like many these days. And so plagued with these deep depressions, and if it wasn't depression, it was very acute anxiety. And one night I woke up in the middle of the night and again feeling this intense fear and anxiety and almost a nausea. I didn't like who I was, I didn't like the world, and a thought came into my head that said, I can't live with myself any longer. And then the thought came back a couple of times, and at that moment I became conscious of this thought, and I said, what does this thought mean? I can't live with myself. There's an I and there's a self that I cannot live with, so am I one or am I two? So I just looked at this, the structure of this sentence, this thought that had arisen, and at that moment I realized that when I talk about it now, I'm explaining something that I didn't understand at that time conceptually, but it just happened. It was an insight that happened non-conceptually. I realized that the unhappy self wasn't who I am. The unhappy person with its continuous succession of unhappy thoughts about my life and what's going to happen to me and regrets about the past and fears about the future, all that was the unhappy self. And I suddenly, because this sentence arose, I can't live with myself, I realized there's a self and here's I. And there was separation happened between the unhappy self and the I. What exactly that meant, I didn't know at the time. I just realized the next day I woke up and I felt deep peace inside myself, which never completely left me since then. And only much later I understood that the I was the stillness or the consciousness that I am beyond thought. And the self that I couldn't live with was the mind-made self, consisting of habitual thought patterns and emotions that go with these thought patterns, and that wasn't real. So that collapsed. The mind-made sense of self was no longer there, and there was simply a sense of presence or beingness, non-problematic beingness, aliveness, and that was, I realized, who I am, not a mind-made self, but something that cannot really be defined. It's consciousness itself.